Station on 11952 row 10. Session number 11952, row 10.
Mr. Roselle, row 10. You were telling me about the commandant who said he knew you had contraband.
Yes. Well,
I know.
In our camp, in our hut, there were Frenchmen, Italians. Of course, you remember, in the First World War, we had practically all the world on our side. Serbians, Russians, and so on. Well, the Russians, when they signed a separate peace, they were made to work, and most of the Russians in our camp were Russian officers, but they made them work, and they worked in the fields. Well, it wasn't long before, and also the Red Cross used to send the Russians bulk parcels, cases of biscuits and tea and sugar and so on. They cut that out because they'd made a separate peace with Germany, so they had nothing, only the German rations. So they used to come to us, if they'd been in the fields and they'd got potatoes. Remarkable to me how many potatoes they could carry on them. They had them down their trousers, down their shirt, in their sleeves, and they wore their overcoat over their shoulders and the sleeves were tied. And they'd come along and say, we've got potatoes, you know, we want bread.
Trade you.
Yes, and when we had our parcels, we didn't eat the German bread. And if you had a little school of four, say, you some accumulated quite a bit of bread. So we used to buy the stuff off them. Well, the huts were double lined, weatherboarding outside, tungsten grooved inside. Well, we made places where the windows were so we could slide the tungsten grooved along, we pulled the nails out, put it all in, it would drop down into that gap. And we had a thing at the bottom where we could get it out when we wanted it. So we had a store of potatoes.
Or storage bins.
That way, yeah. And when the cabbages were being cooked, they could even smuggle cabbages, fat cabbages in, you know, white cabbages they were, but they were damn good. We used to do the same with that. We had to cut them in half and drop them down. And when the medical stuff came, the Germans were short of all that. The Red Cross, every now and again, sent a parcel. But they also sent a letter to one of the... one who was your chief among the prisoners at that camp, telling them when it was likely to arrive. We bribed the German fellow who received the packets so that we could give him so much, a tablet of soap or something like that, and he let the fellow smuggle it out. And in the beginning, when we came back, we were supposed to be searched. Well, if we got anything when we were out, because we met workers who were working on the land or whatnot, they gave us beetroots and all sorts. Well, it was forbidden. So when we lined up, one had to go in the command tour and be searched. So we handed everything to the back row, you see. And then when you came out, you gave it back to them. They'd been searched, you see. And that went on for quite a while. We were able to do it. They tumbled to that and made each man, when he came out of the command tour, he had to go into the camp through the gate. Result was, the fellow with all the booty was the last man. He went in the clink. You got fierce tag, arrest him. 14 days of rest, you know.
What sort of work did they have you doing?
Well, according to the Geneva Convention, anybody above the rank of a corporal did not work in Germany. But there was a hole in that you could drive. Apparently you could do camp work. Well, our commandant, he said, you know, I'm not going to sit doing nothing. You do camp work. So he arranged that there was a track went over the moors to the nearest village. The supplies came to this village from the nearest railway junction, which was miles away, by the old-fashioned stagecoach. All their supplies for the Germans and for us and came in this stagecoach. So we used to go down to this place, Steuben, which was probably 3 or 4 kilometres away across the moor. He said we must have a proper track because we pulled a cart. The prisoners pulled a cart, you see, to get the stores. So he arranged that we would dig a ditch on each side of the road all the way down to the village. Well, that took us all about 1 year to do that. But that was camp work, he said, because without that road you couldn't supply the camp. That's how they got away with it, work. But normally we didn't work. Although a lot of the Germans used to say to us, in Deutschland, alles arbeiten. Everybody works in Germany.
Were there ever any plans for escape?
There were, but we had prisoners who were caught, came back to our camp and were imprisoned because they had escaped, but we never had any scheme to escape in our camp, for of course it was impractical. We got maps smuggled in, but between us and the Holland border there were two rivers, one of them very fast flowing and wide, and there were ever so many sort of canals and locks and all sorts, you see. And that was one of the things that nearly all the prisoners, you try to save up enough food to take you, usually on the first or second night they fell in the water somewhere in the dark, and then all their food was gone and was ruined, you see. That happened to several of them I talked to. But there were a lot of successful escapes. We heard about somebody who was in our camp, was related to this. He had been a policeman from Liverpool, and apparently he was a very strong swimmer, and he swam the Rhine into Switzerland. And our commandant said to us, if you want to escape, let me know, I'll give you all the kit and everything else, and you still won't succeed. That's what I used to say.
Obviously a man with a sense of humour.
Yeah. And also, he made us dig a trench all round the hut, 6 feet deep, and they measured it and made sure it was 6 feet deep, not 6'3". If it was too much, you put some back, you know, all this palaver, to keep us occupied. That was supposed to ensure that we weren't tunnelling. But to us, getting out of the camp was not hard, not there. It was getting away and food and things like that. But we were always afraid, because occasionally we were searched, and they even took your straw mattress out and searched that. Well, I got a new mattress for somebody who was being shifted, and he was one of these keen on escaping. He'd already got maps and whatnot. And I thought they'd all be in my mattress when they came, and they rip it open out in the yard. But fortunately for me, there was nothing hidden. But that's the sort of thing you never knew, really. And I got 14 days once, because they used to say on Triton, you know, and you all go out, and I had a cake of soap and I hid it up above my bunk, wooden bunk, you know, they were double tiered, and when I came back in, it's gone. So I went straight out, and the old commandant, he hadn't left the compound, so I said to him, the Dolmasher, an Englishman, that one in particular, he was a lad, he was a Cockney lad, he was a Dolmasher. I said, just a minute, tell the commandant. So he shouted to him, you know, and he said, right. And I said, they pinched my so-and-so soap, your postings. He said, what? And I told him again, and then he said, Germans are not thieves, meet, sieben Tage, arrest and be strafed, you know, 7 days in the clink.
It was the classic.
So I said, he just pinched it. 14 Tage, he said, 14 days. And that was that. That's how they went on. But the trouble was, when you were put in the clink, they were something like a telephone booth, and they were only made of thin matchboarding. And in the winter, of course, you were frozen, and you never knew when you were coming out. You know, they had 7 days, you might be in there a fortnight, or you might be told to Bicklauf and come out, you know. And you couldn't lay down. If you had strenger rest, there was a little shutter over the little window, they put that over so it was semi-dark, and they took the piece of wood that you sat on away. So you were left there, which means you squatted on the ground and you had nowhere to put your legs, only up the wall. That was the sort of torture you got, you know. Well, most of them just rode it, you know. Wouldn't let them know that they were affected.
What was the food like when you were in the clink?
German food. We got over that in one camp until it was rumbled, because most of the posterns there were what they call them, Landstormers, farmers and Dahl, and they used to take you out to the latrines, which were in the camp once a night. You know, that's all you could do. That was another form of torture. I very seldom drank when I was in there, because if you want to go and you can't, you know. Anyway, what we used to do, they knew it was at night time, last thing at night, you see, you went to the latrine. Well, our fellas used to go in the latrine. We'd come in there, and before you went in, you know, the Germans would say, Ein, zwei, fein, drei, vier, sim, sim, vic, you know, seven, right. The other fellas came out, and they used to line up. Perhaps two freshmen, you see, and five of the originals. And when they came out, you know, the old Jerry would say, I'm swine, dry, marsh, and put them back in the clink. Well, you had two men out who could get your parcels again, you see, because they wouldn't let you send anything into them. That's how we used to do it. Because if you had a fortnight on German food again, you were back where you were almost, you know, because even the parcels, we were always ravenous, but we were healthy. But you couldn't stand being hungry much, you know, really.
How did you hear about the armistice?
The first thing we knew, we were very near to Bremerhaven. We were at a place called Kassebrook, near Bremerhaven. Sailors came in the camp, and they said that
German sailors
and a group of others and they all had red rosettes on, and they got the Dolmasher out and told him that there'd been a revolution in Germany, which there was. The Hohenzollerns had all been kicked out, which they had. We didn't believe it at the time, but there we are. And they said the country was all being run by Soldatenrat, soldiers' councils, and we were all brethren now, and we will be brothers, and so on. So the first thing our chaps said was, well, we've got to, because there were always Englishmen in the clink, they'd done something or other, because this commandant had his son killed on the Western Front, so he wasn't very loving towards the British, you know. So you were in there at any pretext. We said, we've got some of them in there. So he turned to the chef, Sergeant Sheffs. He'd been the regimental sergeant major in charge. And the commandant had taken the only horse they had and gone into Holland. Because if they didn't put the rose, red rosette up, they weren't joining the revolution. You see, well, he didn't join it. So they said, well, let them out. So they all came up, you know, and they said, what's the matter? Oh, well, they said, there's a revolution. We're all brothers now, you know. And we said, well, what about opening the gates and letting us go home? We can't do that. This sailor, and they were the soldat and rat, you see. You can't do that because there could be Germans who don't feel the same as we do, and you could be in trouble. So, and we're responsible to your government. You'll have to stay here until we get boats to take you home, you know. And that was that. So one of the Cockney fellows who was in my school, we had a school of four at that time, he was a cheeky devil. He was a sergeant major in that previously, and we went to this Sergeant Chef, who was now in charge of the camp, you see, and we said, we want to go out, you know, can we go out? No. So anyway, we'd ordered tobacco, and you know, they cut our cigarettes up. Well, we couldn't do much with that tobacco. If you had it in the pipe, it was too hot. So we told the people to send us a plug that we carry in our pocket, you see. So we had some of this plug tobacco, and he gave him a bit, and he went, chewed it, you know. Good, us is good. What about us going out? We'll come back, you know. Well, we didn't know. So in the end, he said, oh, yes, come to the guard room. And he showed us to the guard, these two men had to go out. Well, we took what we had with us, what we could get. Soap. We had penny packets. They were only penny packet, but they'd had no soap for a couple of years, you know. And a tin of bully that had been smuggled out in the tin. Away we went. And we went to a farmhouse, and we said we wanted some flesh. Ooh, they hadn't got any flesh. Oh, yes, they got conigeons, rabbits. So we said, you know, haben Sie das Conigeon verkaufen? Yeah, showed them a soap. He called his family around, they smelt it. And the wife, ooh, so on. And we got a rabbit. He killed it, they had it in hutches in their sort of living room. Well, part of their house. We took that home, back to camp that night, and of course when we began cooking it with our potatoes and cabbage that we had stowed away, all the Frenchmen came round, you know, what's that smell? Ooh. We told them. Well, they were all asking the sergeant the next day to go out, but he wouldn't have let them, but he let us out again, because we gave him a whole plug. And what else? We got something. We got from them, sort of some form of chitlins or something, and we got some chicken feet, chicken legs rather. You know, like a
drumstick
from them. Yeah, and so we had a couple of expeditions, and also we were felt lovely walking. But a couple of days after, I think we were shifted. We didn't know where we were going. But we went to Salto, and that's a camp. It went over hill and dale, you know. There were thousands there. Russians, all the Allies were there. And when we had British officers there, and as soon as we got there, they told us that the parcels were coming in here, but they weren't going to send them out to the little camps. So if you like to parade at so-and-so o'clock, we'll dish them out to you. So we went there and we were astounded. There must have been a whole wagon of parcels. We went home to our little hut, you know, our hut rather. We were rich men. Food was riches. And a couple of days after, we had a good feed, of course. A couple of days after, there was a Italian sergeant came to see us, and he was hungry, you know, and he asked us if we'd like some hot pot, because between prisoners, it was German was the language. He could give us warm water, make us tea and that. Anyway, we said, yes, do so, you know, and gave him something. He came back with tea, so we gave him something to eat. And in the end, he was making, we told him he had the run of our parcels that were there. He was making us meals as he thought. And in a couple of days, his moustache was waxed, and he was upright and clean looking, you know. And he had a couple of serfs with him. But he fetched our dinner in, he called them, and he was like a major domo. It was funny.
Obviously a natural restaurateur.
Yeah. Mm. They're all little things I think of now, you know.
How did you eventually get back home?
Well, they told us that we were called, and one of the English officers, there were about three of them there, said, we've got a train. We think it's not a rumour. We think it's true. There's a train coming into the siding, which came right into the camp. This huge camp, you see, like a town it was, really. And at 2 or 3 in the morning, he said, but mind you, there's only room for so many Britishers, you lot, you see. And if a Frenchman or a Russian gets on, there'll be one Englishman less. So make sure, and don't say anything about it. Keep it secret. Anyway, we went down to the train at this time, and there was already half the camp waiting for it, you know. Russians, Frenchmen. We really had to do it bodily to pull them off and get them out to get all... Anyway, eventually they were pushed out and we set off. We didn't know where we were going, but we went to Hamburg to the docks, and it ran right into the docks. And the first thing we saw, we couldn't believe our eyes, there was a blue jacket, one of our sailors, standing on the quay, and he was playing a mouth organ. And see, some of the fellas said, that's one of our sailors, isn't it? Yes. Anyway, we got out, and down below, I suppose it was low tide or something, there was a torpedo boat, and he was one of them. And alongside there was a merchant ship. I remember the name, City of Pune, and the other one was His Majesty's Ship Radiant. And they lined us up on the quay, and the merchant skipper and the naval skipper. And the merchant skipper said, I can't take this lot. He said, I'm only supposed to take 1,200. And apparently it was about 1,600, you see. And the old naval fella said, why can't you go to the ship and hold them? Yes, but I haven't got enough food for them. He said, these chaps haven't had a square meal in years. I'll do all right, you know. On board you go. And he said, oh, by the way, do you want these fellas to stay? The old postons, I always remember them. They were still with us, the guards with their rifles. And they said, no, we don't want them anymore. Tell them to go, because a lot of the fellas could speak German and swear in German. And they told us, I was always sorry for them, because they looked hopeless and helpless, and they sort of turned around. Where they were going, I don't know.
Don't suppose they knew either.
No, no. And, yes, sir? What? Oh, yes, yeah. You've got to go home, haven't you? And also, a lot of the fellas on the quay were in a bad state because they'd heard a rumour, only a rumour, some time ago, that a ship was coming. And they'd hopped it from wherever they were, on farms and whatnot, and they'd been hiding in the wood stacks for 2 or 3 days, you know, with no water, no food or anything. And, of course, they came out when the ship came, and they were glad. But they were in a bit of a mess, some of them, because some of them had been here about 5 days. Anyway, we all got on board, and the skipper said we would be sailing in the morning, I suppose, to do with the tide. And I remember looking over the side, and there was a ladder going down to the deck of this destroyer. So I suppose I was a bit adventurous, I thought. So I climbed down, and when I climbed down on the deck, there was a sailor on sentry. He said, down there, pointed to a hole in the deck, as it were. So I went down there, and I was in the sort of cabin. There were already about 3 ex-prisoners down there. So they said, sit down. What would you like? Do a rum? So of course I said yes. I was in no state to drink alcohol. Anyway, they dished up salmon and tinned salmon, of course, and white bread that they cooked themselves. You know? And I had white bread and salmon, and ooh, beautiful meal, and tots of rum. You know, after a bit, I was enjoying myself. After a bit, the old skipper came in. He said, "You lads, get back on your own ship." He said, "We're sailing before the morning." And I remember climbing up this ladder, and I thought, I'll never get up there. But I did. And I slept like a top that night, because we were all in hammocks in this, we were in the hold of this merchant ship with all hammocks, you know. And when we woke up in the morning, of course, we were all swinging because the boat was out. We went past Kiel, and a lot of mines were floating round, and they had some marines on board, and they were exploding them with rifle fire. And we came to Hull eventually, and we were greeted by ladies when we landed with cups of tea, etc. And we went to Ripon, and we were all examined by doctors and had disinfectant baths and Lord knows what. And then I think we were given some money and sent home. I arrived at King's Cross, and I always remember, as a matter of fact, I told John, I don't know whether he's put it in the book, I don't think he has, when I got outside of King's Cross, just, you know, I thought, oh, looking round like this, shall I get a bus or shall I get the tube? And a feminine voice behind me said, "Hello, soldier boy, you looking for a good time?" I thought, hello, I'm in London. Anyway, about a couple of days after, I met Winnie again, didn't I?
Did you have to go report back for demobilisation?
Oh, sorry, I pulled that. French habit of gesticulating, you see.
So you went home. How long were you at home then?
We were given about 3 months' leave, weren't we, Wynne? So prisoner of war leave. About 3 months, yes.
And then what happened? Did you have to go back to a camp to be formally demobilised?
No, we went back, and they were going to send us to Red Hill. In fact, they sent us to Red Hill. We were going to relieve some troops who were guarding prisoners of war. And we were going to... And when we told the old colonel that we were ex-prisoners of war, he rang up London and they told us to get back again. It was a bad move. They didn't want ex-prisoners guarding prisoners, you see. And so we were demobilised in London.
At the depot in London?
Yes. So that was that. I was out of it in no time. I'll take this off. Oh.
How long was it? How long did it take you to adjust to being a civilian again, having been in the army?
Well, I couldn't give any time to it, but I sort of looked forward. I knew I had to earn a living and so on, and I sort of got on with it, I think.
Did you find work easily and quickly?
Well, before the war, I'd been 3 years at a technical school. I got a scholarship there, and I'd got a job in the engineering department of the GPO. So my job was waiting for me, you see. As a matter of fact, joining the army as I did, when I went back there, they told me that they'd sort of queried as to whether I should have been sacked, because I'd changed from one department to another without asking permission. But they decided that they let it go. That's what I was actually told by one of the chief engineers. Well, so I went back there to a testing branch at Mount Pleasant and started work. And I thought that was normal, you know. And as a matter of fact, I thought, well, all this hasn't been going on. And I always felt capable. Although I left as a boy and I'd come back as a man, I sort of felt capable. Well, you can tell how capable I felt. Well, whilst I was on leave, we got married.
Do you think your military service taught you any important lessons?
Well, I think I became more philosophical about anything happening to me, because I remember during the Second World War, I never wanted to hide or get into a dugout or anything. I thought, I'm okay unless I get a direct hit on me, and that was that. In fact, I was pulled up for not going down the dugout in one place where I was. They'd all been down during an alert, but I hadn't. I didn't want to go down. And the governor said to me, "You weren't there." He said, "I want you down there. You have to go undercover." That sort of thing. So whether that shows any sort of philosophy or what, I don't know. But same as I remember, there were bombs dropping around near Croxley one time, and some neighbours of ours came tearing along, didn't they, Wynn? Knocking at the door, because they came from London every night to take shelter in Croxley, you see. They lived in the centre of London. Knocking at the door, and I said, "Hello, come in," you know. And they thought that being with us would make them safer somehow. I don't know, crowd, herd instinct or something. But